Black Panther movement.
The Black Panthers were absolutely unique.
We stand on the eve of a black revolution, brother.
Now we have voices within the community that we're not going to continue to turn the other cheek.
Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, voices of resistance from the nation's capital, produced for WPFW, your Pacifica radio station in Washington, D.C. I'm Esther Averam. Well, 2016 marks the 50th anniversary of 1966, the 50th anniversary of the call for black power by SNCC leader Stokely Carmichael, also known as Kwame Ture. 2016 also marks the 50th anniversary of the founding in Oakland, California of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, which made an armed stand against police brutality, organized free community breakfasts and health programs, and built coalitions with other oppressed people in this country and around the globe. They are known internationally for their efforts to bring about revolutionary change in an America still wresting itself from the grip of Jim Crow. An official Black Panther 50th anniversary commemoration and celebration gets underway Thursday, October 20th in Oakland, California. And tonight, the day that this program is airing, October 14th, at Howard University here in D.C., there will be a 50th anniversary conversation between former Black Panthers Paul Coates and Lynn French. Today, we'll be speaking with Lynn French, as well as Howard University professor Josh Myers, who's an organizer of tonight's program. Gerald Horn is in the mix, as well as our environmental justice producer, Michelle Roberts, just back from a mass action in Houston. So, as always, we have a lot packed for you into this hour, and we'll get started with our headlines. The Stop Police Terror Project DC, Black Lives Matter DC, and other organizations continue to pressure city officials this week about the deaths of Alonzo Smith and Terrence Sterling at the hands of police. Sterling was shot to death by DC police officer Brian Traynor on September 11th while driving erratically on his motorcycle. There are a number of questions surrounding the case. First, why was Sterling killed? Secondly, why has no footage of the shooting been produced? These and other questions were asked Monday at a rally at 3rd Street and M Streets Northwest. Friends of Terrence Sterling and clergy joined with organizations for the rally, then took to the streets, shutting down New York and New Jersey avenues before marching to Chinatown and shutting it down as well. Longtime activist and political prisoner Kwasi Situ was there to support the demand for justice.
We need to put the police on trial. Have community tribunals. We've done an investigation. The investigation's right here. Put them on trial. Damn the U.S. Attorney's Office, because they're not going to do a damn thing. You understand what I'm saying? The current police chief, we're not going to lead this to the police, because we know that all they do is cover up. That's all they do, all over the country. So why should we leave it to them?
Organizers are asking the community to tweet, Facebook, and email the mayor of D.C., Muriel Bowser, and demand that she break her silence and answer, why was Terrence Sterling killed? Why were the body cameras turned off? And demand that she release the name of the police officer in the car with Officer Brian Traynor. Thank you to Lydia Curtis for her reporting at that rally. And in an update to the case of Alonzo Smith, who died in D.C. special police custody last November, Beverly Smith posted on Facebook last night after her meeting with the U.S. Attorney's Office that there is no indictment in her son's death. Members of Pan-African Community Action and other supporters of the Smith family, including a group of mothers from Brazil, rallied yesterday outside the office of the U.S. Attorney in Northwest D.C. while the meeting was going on. After the meeting, Beverly Smith told reporters that she will continue the fight for justice in her son's death, which was ruled a homicide.
As I've been talking all along about the ex parte proceedings, I don't know how Jean Saxton presented this case. From what she's telling me, she presented this case, it appears to me, from a murder perspective, okay? Murder perspective, you have to get in someone's mind and say they had intent. Okay, this is what she told me. She didn't say anything about any lesser charge or if she even submitted a lesser charge. As a matter of fact, what charge she even presented to the grand secret grand jury, I do not know. But this fight is not over.
No, it's not.
It is not over.
No, it's not. It's
I am not discouraged, okay? I'm not even concerned about the silver case, about the money. That's what she mentioned. I'm not concerned about that. What I am concerned about is having these two special police officers indicted for the murder of my son.
Yes.
They killed my last breath. Okay, I'm going to fight for the justice for my son. They still do not want to release the name, but it's okay. Because, guarantee this, I will have the four names of both of them within a month, and I will release them to the press. I promise you that.
Other issues of the criminal justice system remain in the news and in the streets locally and nationally. On Wednesday, a coalition of organizations, clergy, formerly incarcerated, activists, family, and friends rallied in front of the White House on behalf of more than 50,000 nonviolent, federally convicted, and overcharged persons, asking President Obama to release them before year's end. One of the groups, the Exodus Foundation, has submitted an application for the release. Pastor Dexter Nuttall of New Bethel Baptist Church welcomed the crowd.
Everybody here that's ever needed a second chance, or a third chance, or a fourth chance. I wonder if there's anybody here that loves justice. Is there anybody out here in this great city on this beautiful day that loves mercy? Well, we are here today on behalf of over 1 million people who are in cages. Over 1 million paid people who have committed nonviolent offenses and they are in cages right now. And I believe that cages are not for people. Cages are for animals. Cages are not for people who have the potential to be doctors and lawyers and legislators and professionals and people who can make our communities better. We have a problem in this country. We like putting people in cages.
Those gathered rallied around the theme, Time's Up, Let Me Go. The coalition is supported by local organizations Cease Fire, Don't Smoke, the Brothers and the Sisters, Black Lives Matter DC, New Bethel Baptist Church, and Mount Enon Baptist Church. And on Thursday night, UDC Law Students for Innocence held a panel discussion with attorneys and exonerees. Chantel James has more.
An audience of law students and community members gathered for a discussion of injustices in the legal system. Panelists Robert Hall of Hall & Setty, Kate Philippot, scientific and legal consultant, Leslie Bass of the Neighborhood Network Organization, and Walter Lomax, who served 40 years for a crime he did not commit. Bass and Hall gave their experiences working in defense of clients accused of crimes, while Lomax and Bass drew from their experiences as wrongly convicted prisoners who were eventually exonerated. The panel was moderated by Marlon Parker, a law student at UDC and a member of Law Students for Innocence. Parker shares with us the vision behind the panel.
We were just compelled. We were compelled to take on a case of wrongful convictions. We're looking forward to taking on cases in the future, and this was along those lines. We had a forensic analyst here, as well as an attorney who's more than competent. He's got two connotations, by far the most in the state of Virginia. And we've had two exonerees with compelling stories. One was, he served nearly 40 years in prison. He was wrongfully convicted another 10 years. And he was only awarded $50,000 in the second suit. Those are issues. Those are, this problematic. And it's disheartening. That's why we're all here, and that's what we're fighting against.
For On the Ground, this is Chantal James signing off.
In Planet News, there were actions here and around the country this week in solidarity with those taking a stand against the Dakota Access Pipeline and for environmental justice. Our environmental justice producer, Michelle Roberts, was on the ground in Houston at a protest at the headquarters of Energy Transfer Partners, and we'll get the latest from her later in the show. But to finish up our headlines, we'll go to author and activist Professor Gerald Horn for his global geopolitical analysis, and actually for this week for culture and media. Good morning, Gerald.
Good morning to you.
So in this week, you know, when we are inundated with news about Donald Trump's lewd remarks and alleged sexual assaults, the U.S. has fired missiles against Yemen. They've threatened to retaliate against Russia for what it says are hacked emails, and against Syria for fighting in its own civil war. There's a lot happening in the globe. I wonder what your thoughts are today.
Well, I'm sure your listeners are aware of the fact that we're in a very perilous moment right now, particularly as it concerns Syria. You may recall that just a few days ago, Secretary of State John Kerry said that he was going to make a referral to the International Criminal Court with regard to what Russia and Syria have been doing, Syria, of course, in its own country. What's striking, of course, is that the African Union has been the sternest critic of the ICC, the International Criminal Court, because of its predilection for going after exclusively leaders of African rebel groups or regimes. Perhaps we could see it as being a step forward that Russia and Syria are not part of Africa, but actually it's more dangerous and serious than that, because quite frankly, there is a lot of loose talk in Washington right now about a war with Russia, believe it or not, and I dare say that that kind of chatter will become even more incessant the closer we get to Inauguration Day in January 2017 with the prospect of Hillary the Hawk being the next U.S. president.
What is the latest in what's happening in the Philippines? I wanted to ask you about this last week, actually, but the president there has had a lot of stern, that's a mild word, words for President Obama. And how does that fit into this whole scenario with Syria?
Well, the situation in the Philippines is also very complicated. On the one hand, you have President Duterte, who has conducted a rather lawless offensive against what he considers to be criminals and drug addicts and drug pushers. At the same time, President Duterte has his thumb on the pulse of the international situation when he acknowledged that China is the rising power, the United States is a declining power, and that the present military maneuvers that the Philippines military is having with the United States will be the last maneuvers that are held, at least under his regime. He's on his way to Beijing with a plane full of Filipino business executives. He has said that he also wants to buy military materiel, not only from the United States, but also from Russia. And that has outraged Washington and is another factor that's pushing the planet perilously close to a dangerous international situation.
Well, this is also the first week for The Birth of a Nation being in theaters. Last week I called it a must-see, but there were also some who panned the movie. Women in particular seemed to review the movie, I thought, with more of an eye on Nate Parker's controversy than on Nat Turner, which the movie was about. So what are your thoughts about the movie?
Well, I agree with your assessment. I think that your listeners should run, not walk, to see Birth of a Nation. First of all, you have to look at it in the context of anti-slavery epics. I'm thinking of Burn, directed by the Italian director Ponte Cordova. He also did Battle of Algiers, with the stars Marlon Brando in 1970, 12 Years a Slave, Django, of course, The Other Francisco, the Cuban film. And I think that Birth of a Nation stands shoulder to shoulder with those particular epics. I think that the critics are a bit misplaced, to put it mildly, in terms of their critique of this film. I think it's a must-see.
Okay. And I think that you're going to... Are you going to participate? There's a panel this coming weekend, I think, in Los Angeles at Esawan Books, and I think you were encouraging us to check that out if it was live streamed or to perhaps tap into it somehow. Are you participating in that panel?
No, but I have to confess I'm conducting this rear guard offensive to try to pump up the numbers for Birth of a Nation, because I fear that this film will disappear from the theaters sooner rather than later, and that'll be a grave sin and omission, because it's really one of the most stirring anti-slavery epics graphics that has been produced in this country thus far, the fact that it can be produced at a time when the United States might be on the verge of electing a Donald J. Trump to the presidency makes it even more important. And I would urge listeners to rush to see this film.
Well, speaking of artistic presentations, I know you'll be here in D.C. on October 20th, this coming Thursday and Friday, October 21st, for the Hearst and Wright Literary Awards, reading at Busboys and Poets, I believe the Tacoma location on Thursday, and then Friday at the awards presentation here in the city. And you're a nominee for your book on Haiti that we have actually discussed many times, Confronting Black Jacobins, the U.S., the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic. So congratulations.
Well, thank you for that. And I look forward to seeing you and other friends of your program at Busboys and Poets, and perhaps even at the award ceremony on Friday.
Right, and that's the Busboys and Poets, I think the Tacoma location on Carroll Street in Tacoma, D.C. All right, well, thank you, Gerald. Thanks for joining me this morning.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, finally, there are lots of other arts and activism in the DMV. I'm really excited to be a part of Migration 61, an exhibit of works that imagine what the 61st panel could be in painter Jacob Lawrence's Migration series. And that's starting tomorrow. Works will be on exhibit actually at Busboys and Poets locations around the area. And members of Black Artists of D.C. are featured in a new exhibit up at Blackburn Center at Howard University. And in an exhibit on view through tomorrow at New Door Creative in Baltimore, the co-founder of BADC, Aziza Claudia Gibson Hunter, takes a coded approach to the subject of gentrification.
I lived in several cities where I saw the process take place. And gentrification is not just different people moving into a neighborhood. It's a system. And I think that the system is linked to the drugs that show up in our neighborhoods and the guns that show up in our neighborhoods and the commodification of that whole process, the Tyvek, all the materials that are used for this thing called gentrification to take place. So it's a certain amount of almost violence that takes place in a community, the dislocation of people, the loss of property, the loss of a sense of place, the erasure of memory. There's a lot of things that happen there. And not to say that there aren't Black neighborhoods want to have nice shops. We want to have clean streets. We want to be able to fix our houses up so that they look beautiful. But it just seems as if it comes when other people come to the neighborhood. We have food deserts, and then we have Whole Foods.
Something,
yes, sprouts up. And I think what I wanted is for people to investigate that, to think about it deeply.
Occupational Hazards is on view at New Door Creative, 1601 St. Paul Street in Baltimore, through tomorrow, Saturday, October 15th. And those are our headlines and happenings. There's actually so much happening. I tried to squeeze in Code Pink is going to be out in front of the White House tomorrow on behalf of police violence, advocating against police violence and gun violence and creating a uniform policing and reporting code in this country. And also the Coalition to End the Israeli Occupation is also having a big gathering this weekend. Lots of things. There's a film opening, another film. Maybe we can get to that later. When we come back, a 50th anniversary for the Black Panthers. Stay with us.
Breaking rocks out here on the chain gang, breaking rocks and serving my time. Breaking rocks out here on the chain gang, cause they done convicted me of crime. Hold it steady right there while I hit it. Well, I reckon that ought to get it. Been working and working, but I still got so terribly far to go. I committed crime, Lord, I need crime of being hungry and poor. I left the grocery store, man, breathing when they caught me robbing a store. Hold it steady right there while I hit it. Well, I reckon that ought to get it. Been working and working, but I still got so terribly far to go. I heard the judge say 5 years on chain gang you gonna go. I heard the judge say 5 years of labor. I heard my old man scream, Lord, no.
Well, 2016 marks the 50th anniversary of 1966, the 50th anniversary of the call for Black Power by SNCC leader Stokely Carmichael, also known as Kwame Ture, and also marks the 50th anniversary of the founding in Oakland, California, of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, which made an armed stand against police brutality, organized free community breakfast and health programs, and built coalitions with other oppressed people in this country and around the globe. They are known internationally for their efforts to bring about revolutionary change in an America still wresting itself from the grip of Jim Crow. An official Black Panther 50th anniversary commemoration and celebration gets underway Thursday, October 20th in Oakland, California. And tonight at 7 p.m. at Howard University here in D.C., there will be a 50th anniversary conversation between former Black Panthers Paul Coates and Lynn French. Lynn French is here in the studio with me today, as well as Josh Myers, a professor at Howard University, who is an organizer of tonight's program. Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining me. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
Josh. Okay, so when I spoke to you yesterday, Lynn, you were talking about how the primary, I guess, accomplishment of the Black Panthers was that you all said no to the oppression as usual that was going on. And I was thinking that, you know, today people might think that saying no was easy. So I'm asking you to kind of talk about what it was like to say no, what it took to stand up, and what was the kind of final straw for a lot of people that made them say no?
Well, if you look at, am I too?
Go ahead.
If you look at the long arc of the civil rights movement, in 1966, pretty much the nonviolent civil rights movement was coming to an end in the South. But as a result of the Great Migration, the lion's share of the African American population in this country was living in urban centers that were untouched by, that weren't directly influenced by the nonviolent civil rights movement. And so, although people were rooting for Dr. King and for the sit-ins and all that, it wasn't changing the impact of urban police departments and slum dwellings, lack of housing code enforcement, poverty, bad schools on so many African Americans. And when Stokely Carmichael, and in this context I think of him as Stokely because he had not yet changed his name, when he first uttered Black Power in Mississippi, that really, it just resonated with everyone that it was time for us to assert ourselves, and perhaps the answer would not be in asking people for permission to eat with them or go to school with them or to do all the things, the victories of the civil rights movement, but perhaps what needed to happen was we needed to assert ourselves and talk about self-determination. And so when you look at the 10-point program of the Black Panther Party, the number one principle in the 10-point program is we want freedom. We want the power to determine our own destiny. And that's what drew me and many other people, although different ones of us followed different applications of that in life, that was the underlying principle that applied to everyone, that we had to speak for ourselves. If we saw our children hungry, I was in the Illinois chapter in Chicago. If our children were so hungry that they couldn't learn in school, then rather than to say, please feed them, what we did was we organized a free breakfast for school children program. And we just announced that we were going to do it. We got food donations from people. We were going to open it at on the west side of Chicago. And the night before it was supposed to open, the Chicago police, who at the time were like Gestapo police, broke into the place where we were going to have the breakfast program, smashed up the food, and urinated on it. And we held a press conference the next day saying, look at what they did. We're just trying to feed children. And food donations streamed in from all over the city so that we were able to simultaneously open programs on all over the west side and the south side, which is where African Americans lived at that time in Chicago. It's just, that's just a snippet, but what we were doing was asserting ourselves and thinking about how will we live as free people, and what kind of world do we want to create for our children so that they can be free people.
Mm-hmm. Wow. You know, I'm thinking about is the fact that as much as the Panthers accomplish all that, you know, you're kind of telling us today, and I consider this really precious, like oral history and history telling, because so much of our story doesn't get told.
Absolutely.
But as much as the Panthers accomplished, they were also destroyed in the end by COINTELPRO and state violence. And so I know when you normally talk about the Panthers, you talk about Fred Hampton, the charismatic leader in Chicago, and you said you actually lived in the same building where he was murdered by the Chicago police. So I'm just wondering, you know, people just assume that this kind of surveillance and occurs, and, you know, how much should activists be vigilant about the capacity today for the state to disrupt efforts at social change?
One of the biggest lessons of the Black Panther Party is how we were destroyed by counterintelligence programs. I'm sure everybody knows about COINTELPRO that was started by J. Edgar Hoover across the country to destroy the Black, to destroy the movement. But when you look at the records of COINTELPRO, about 98 or 99% of the actions were against the Black Panther Party. He talked about the danger of a new Black Messiah in Chicago. We believe that was Fred he was talking about. And he actually ordered the assassination of Fred, because Fred was such a brilliant leader and such a good speaker. He was a pure person at a time that many people were getting high and doing a lot of other things, not exclusively, but doing. Fred was just a purist who would only focus on what needed to be done. He was just a very good person, and it's clear to us all that his assassination was ordered by J. Edgar Hoover. And Edward Hanrahan, who was the state's attorney, that's the what they call the prosecutor in Chicago, accepted that assignment and acted outside of the law to come in the middle of the night and murder Fred. Hmm. But what the lesson from that is not only that the state will resort to whatever means to protect itself, but also the person whose job in the party was to be Fred's bodyguard, his security, had been on the payroll of the FBI. He'd been on the payroll all along, and it wasn't much money. And he got a $300 bonus after Fred was murdered, almost like 30 pieces of silver. So the larger lesson is that you have to be aware of to what extent you can't trust everybody. You have to judge people by their actions. You have to live in a principled manner. And we believed in criticism and self-criticism, and you have to be able to speak with integrity and honesty to each other. If you see someone backsliding or doing something wrong, you have to be able to say without animus, why did you do it this way? This is what our goal is.
Right.
And not let things devolve into internecine squabbles that end up destroying your organization.
Yeah. Now, Josh, you have a scholar's interest in the Black Panther Party, and on this show we've looked at Stanley Nelson's documentary as well as other material from that time. So what does the anniversary mean to you, and what will you be trying to deliver to the community in tonight's program?
Thank you for that question, and thank you for inviting me. It's, for me, a question of amplifying the secondary research and literature that ends up in these documentaries, that ends up in these books on the Black Panther Party, by having students be able to build and create community with those who are actually involved in this movement. And I think there is a great value to having our students, our community, actually in the same space without the interpreters, without the middlemen and middlewomen who have often reframed this history in ways that fit into the dominant narrative of American history, and to revert back to how we get to a point where we can actually build the Black Panther Party into a tradition of black resistance that in many ways has to continue if we are going to continue to exist on this planet. So I think the question of community is at the core of what we're trying to do. One of the things that the students often believe and remember about the Black Panthers, not only is it filtered through these alternative sources, but it is often the case that they assume that these people are no longer with us. And there are many of them that they still can, you know, talk to and engage with. And they have a lot of questions, not only about history, but about how to move forward. And I think being in community with Brother Coates and Sister French will, I think, help them understand in a different way the complex history that they're being taught and read in our communities as well as in our schools.
You know, when you were talking, it reminded me of two things. Like, one of my favorite stories is when Rosa Parks was talking to some young children, and one of them asked her if she knew Harriet Tubman.
Mm-hmm. Right.
it's like, you know, this time.
Yes. Which is kind of interesting, because most people don't realize that Harriet Tubman lived into the 20th century.
Right.
She passes away in 1913. It's possible that there was some connection, at least with Rosa Parks' parents.
Exactly. So. And the other thing is that I participated in WPFW's fundraiser on Sunday, and it was at the Matthew Henson Trail. Mm-hmm. And so I was out with my two little dogs, and at the end of the trail up there in Wheaton, I saw the board with information about him. And I was surprised that he was, mm-hmm. there was a picture of him in the 1950s. Right. This is a person I'm thinking of in the last, you know, two centuries ago, right?
Yes.
I'm thinking of him as someone who lived along, yes. like with Harriet Tubman. So
right.
sometimes we need to really, like you said, you know, we connect with our history and realize that our mm-hmm. history is still living with us,
absolutely.
You know? So, anyway, that was my little experience. So, I think that either this program or the one in Oakland, I saw one of the themes being, where do we go from here?
Yes.
So just, I know you can't, like, you know, do your whole address you're going to do, but what are some ideas about where do we go from here?
You know, I always say, and this may be a disappointment to you, but I believe that one of the few constants in life is change. And I feel very strongly that what we did in my cohort was mm-hmm. we stepped out and we gave it our best shot. And we've raised children, we reach out to young people, but I think that the ultimate change has to come from young people.
Oh,
and
sure.
I don't know that we have all the answers. All that we can do is encourage them. The common bond between Harriet Tubman and Matthew Henson and Rosa Parks is resistance. Let resistance be your motto.
Sure.
But in terms of tactics and approaches, I think that those answers lie with young people.
I would certainly agree with that. It's the challenge that, of course, Frantz Fanon set out, that each generation must, out of relative obscurity, you know, fulfill its mission or betray. And it's a question of being connected to a tradition, but it's also a question of how you apply that tradition uniquely in your own particular context. But I think the thing that is missing, and the thing that is so critical for us, is to remember that we are connected to a tradition of resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't have to reinvent everything if you understand that connection.
So, as we wrap up, I thought about when preparing for this show is that, you know, we have been tracking this whole decade. This whole decade is being celebrated in terms of a 50th anniversary.
Right.
We had a couple years, we were talking about the anniversary of Freedom Summer. We've talked about the anniversary of the March on Washington. I think last year, the anniversary of the passage of the Voting Rights Act, the assassination of Malcolm X, and then here in 2016, looking back at 1966, the Black Power anniversary and Black Panthers. And so I'm wondering, Josh, about today's scholarship producing new information and analysis of that important decade as a whole, because we're going to be in this moment for the next 4 years.
Well, historiography is a tricky thing, especially in American Academy. And so what we are beginning to see is a tension between a political movement that does not fit the traditional American narrative and an attempt to reframe that movement so that it can somehow be a part of American historiography. And it gets really tricky when you think about how the elders are receiving some of these new studies around the kind of labeled Black Power studies. And you see that tension reemerge. In some ways, what the 50th anniversary celebrations are trying to do is harden those new framings of this very complex history in such a way that it's okay to talk about in the official narrative now. It's okay to talk about a movement that is fundamentally, in many ways, revolutionary in a way that allows it to be affirmative in the American liberal tradition. And that's a very dangerous thing. And it speaks to the need for us to really think critically about historiography, but also to write our own narratives and write our own memories of this movement. And that's why I think we should have spaces like the conference and the convening that's happening across the country around this particular movement, and put those in conversation with some of the scholarship that is coming out, and we'll be able to talk about that tension as in a very real way, in a very complicated way as well.
Okay. Well, I want to give people the details about the program again. That's tonight at Blackburn Center on Howard University's campus at 7 p.m.
Yes.
And there'll be a conversation between Paul Coates and Lynn French.
Absolutely.
And I think it was moderated by Ray Baker.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and it's free.
It's free.
And all the public is welcome to come and participate.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you, Howard University Professor Josh Myers and former Black Panther Lynn French and longtime community activist and attorney. And, you know, the life beyond the Black Panthers, right?
Absolutely.
Right.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
Thanks.
When I come back, I'll be with Michelle Roberts and the Fight for Our Planet. Stay with us.
Since a youngin', now we dream of getting rich. Look at me, fantasize about a white picket fence. It's a tree. Used to want a pathfinder with some tents. That's all I need. Throw some 20s on that bitch and get it rinsed. But now I see my dream that the world's a lot bigger ever since. Picked up the paper and they say, nigga, Eddie caught a body, I'm convinced. Anybody is a killer, all you gotta do is push them to the lips. Being timid in the civic, politicking with the pushers and the pimps. I'm trying to write a story, can I get a glimpse? And can I get a glimpse? Last night I had a bad dream that I was trapped in the city. Then I asked, is that really such a bad thing? They robbing things on the daily, can you blaming that ain't ever had things? Guess not. Last night they put up on my at the light like, nice watch, run it. Hands in the air now. Hands in the air, run it. Hands in the air now. Hands in the air, run it. Hands in the air now. Hands in the air. Hands in the air now. Hands in the air. Small town, Hollywood dreams. I know that everything that glitters ain't.
That was J. Cole on the ground, onthegroundshow.org. I'm Esther Averne. Now, there were actions actually here in D.C. and around the country this week in solidarity with those taking a stand against the Dakota Access Pipeline and for environmental justice. Our environmental justice producer, Michelle Roberts, was on the ground in Houston at a protest at the headquarters of Energy Transfer Partners, and they're the key corporation behind the pipeline, right? Good morning, Michelle.
Good morning, Esther. It's a pleasure to be here this morning.
So, tell me what's the latest with the pipeline. I know the court seemed like they ruled that the company can go ahead with the construction of the pipeline, but there are still some limitations being applied by the federal government. So where are things? Are they building it or not?
Well, that is the holding point. I think the biggest issue and challenge right now is this current political climate. There seems to be this stopgap, if you will. You know, we're just days before the major presidential election, and these speaking to which my sister said as how the government will act, to actually respond to the politricking of this, to the politics in this nation, there's a stopgap. So our brothers and sisters out in North Dakota said they will stand and they will not allow this to happen. Speaking for themselves, as you say, we joined in with them, and that's why we went to Energy Transfer Partners to let them know that people from across this nation were standing in solidarity with our brothers and sisters in Standing Rock.
So we actually have a clip. I think it's Sherry Foytlin.
Yes.
In Houston.
Yes.
We can go to that now.
When we connect to that power, we are unstoppable. This is the time of prophecy. We will prevail. There is no doubt in that. And yes, some of us will be injured. Some of us may be lost. Some of us will be imprisoned. But in the end, we will all be free. God bless you for coming out today. Keep everyone in your heart and keep us safe and pull all those behind you forward with you. We stand together for all that ever was and for all that ever will be. And we stand strong and united. Yes, reunited too.
With that child that just walked over here.
Absolutely.
Him to have a future.
Take care. Water is life.
Water is life.
Water is life.
Of intersectionality in the belief that we will win.
Well, water is life. You know, a lot of people don't realize that that is really what people are really fighting for.
Yes.
Yeah, that they want to tunnel this pipeline underneath
yes.
a river that is a water source for people in an entire region.
In an entire region. Think about how we just make people expendable. I mean, water is a human right. And the most beautiful piece, and listening to what Cherie just said about reunited as opposed to united, as we're on this show today, there were black and brown berets and Black Panthers there with us on the ground there at this protest. And we are all continuing the push for our civil and human rights.
Mm-hmm.
This is a continuum of pushing for the rights of black and brown and red people and across this world. And as you listen to the political climate right now, it is more important now than ever that we make sure that we really understand the fundamental issues and impacts of what's happening there. It's my understanding from our brothers and sisters and currently in North Dakota, dogs are being used, folks are being abused and murdered. That's not lifting up to the media surface, if you will. So people who are taking a conscious stand, think about this, for clean water, their lives are being taken away. And yet, we can send billions of dollars to say we're going to fight terrorists when these terroristic attacks are happening to our nation's native indigenous brothers and sisters.
Yeah, and also when I'm thinking about water, we just had a situation where in Flint is still happening, and where we had a river that was made corrosive
Absolutely.
And polluted by a corporation.
Absolutely.
And then the managers there tried to make that river usable as drinking water when they knew it was not drinkable. So that's still going on at a time when they still want to have another river possibly polluted by putting in a pipe underneath it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And let us not forget about even our brothers and sisters in Appalachia and West Virginia,
exactly,
where the Charleston, in Charleston, where the Freedom Industries co-opted 300,000 people are still without clean water. And these are our African brothers and sisters in Institute, West Virginia.
That's
that
right.
Didn't rise to the surface,
right,
as to the impacts of them. So we had to sue the United States government, and thankfully we won a consent decree. Now we are pushing the United States government to implement rules that have been on the books for over 40 years that they've yet to implement.
So I actually wanted to draw the line between the Dakota Access Pipeline, which has gotten more publicity than, you know, a lot of these other struggles that you're talking about. And I know that there was a connection in terms of some of the coalition coming out to either push for implementation of that, but also around, I think, a recent report from the about how the, I guess, either the EPA or has not enforced its civil rights obligations.
Absolutely. We have so many cases. There's a huge backlog of cases, which a lot of folks do not realize, in the EPA Office of Civil Rights that have now dated beyond 30 years. Some of the folks who actually filed these cases are now dead. Attorneys are dead. Children have grown up, married, and had children that are sick, or children have died, people have died, but there's a backlog of cases. And in addition to that backlog of cases, egregious permit activities continue to manifest, continue to be in the pipeline, if you will, for no pun intended, mm-hmm, for passing of additional pollution to be loaded on folks or egregious activities. And so the Center for Public Integrity actually authored a report. And there have been other advocates who joined in with them. This has been an ongoing struggle that has been pushed by, in fact, many of the environmental justice movement folks, some of which, like Richard Moore, Brown Beret, and one of the founders of the environmental justice movement, folks have been pushing for these Title VI permits to be, Title VI violations,
right,
to be addressed.
So what can listeners do right now? Where can they go online, or where can they write or call if they want to be engaged and kind of be a part of that struggle?
What you can do, first of all, you need to make sure that you are in the process of pushing on your congressional and local representatives who are actually pushing for a lot of these policies, if you will, or are not responding to making sure that folks are being held accountable. What they can also do is actually join in to be able to look at other websites like LouisvilleCharter.org. There's work going on across the nation, if you will, standing with our brothers and sisters in Standing Rock, joining our brothers and sisters in the Gulf Coast, and up with there, I'll let you go.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, we're running out
we're
of time.
Short.
All right, so that will do it for us on today's show, On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. A special thanks to my guests, Gerald Horn, Lynn French, Josh Myers, and my environmental justice producer, Michelle Roberts. And thanks again to Chantel James and Lydia Curtis for their reporting out in D.C. this week. And thank you for supporting your station for Jazz and Justice. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can now listen to all of our shows and past shows. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. Now stay tuned for Community Watch and Comment. Raise your voice out there. Peace. I'm gonna go to bed.
other thing. I didn't mean to take up all your sweet time.